Accession number 9145, rule number 3.
Mr. Shawbrook, tape 3. Could I establish, first of all, Mr. Shawbrook, when you say they were flogged and they were getting out of hand, who are you referring to?
To the, well, it was all of it was known as India at that time. And the Indian regiment that was on service with us in Waziristan. Now, I had complete charge that I was responsible for all office equipment, such as typewriters, papers, and what have you. And also, I had to take with me 6 cats.
6 cats?
Cat and nine tails.
For the floggings?
Yeah. And they only used 2, fortunately. And that was, for rank breaking of instructions or orders, as it was known then. And that was, as I say, fouling the waters. We'd had to come round past us. If they'd gone the other side, they were perfectly free. No action could possibly be taken, because our waters weren't being
contaminated.
Fouled.
Yes.
So that was when it was necessary to teach them a lesson, as it was put at that time. I didn't agree with it, so that had nothing to do with me. When we eventually got back, then of course my office work was contained mostly on movement of troops, reports on officers, and court martials.
This was when you got back to Jalundi,
yeah,
was
when
it?
I got back to Jalundi, yes. In brigade headquarters.
Yes. But in Waziristan, which is the area we are mainly interested in, what would your office work have consisted of there?
Oh, reports on the day's action.
And but by writing and reading reports, did you get a good overall picture of what was happening in the country as a whole?
No, not in the country as a whole, only in that particular area where we were operating at the time.
Yes. Well, if you could tell me about that area, you know, what was the scope of the action, would you say?
Well, we used to... We had mountain batteries in operation, of course, and it, at times the fighting was pretty fierce. And we used aircraft at that time for bringing news either from headquarters way back, that they used to come and they had lead pockets on... a ribbon about 20 yards long, so as to steady it, it would come down straight. And then of course it was taken straight to the general, and the thing was wrapped up again for use, so that from that it was more or less the pursuit sending the report back. Many of his reports were strictly confidential, which even I didn't answer. That, but mostly it was the report of action on the particular day, and reports from the different officers coming in to him. And the whole action was fought under difficulties, inasmuch as that they were very conversant, but naturally as they would be, of the terrain, but it was so mountainous and rocky and very difficult to negotiate that many a time you'd be walking up the bed of a river which had dried up, and then when you got notice of a spate coming down or anything like that, you had to scramble as far up as you possibly could to get onto a piece of safety.
Does it make you, when you think of the war in Afghanistan today between the Russians and the Afghan, because after all that's very similar territory,
yes,
isn't it, to Waziristan?
Oh, yes.
Does it give you sort of insight into the reason, yes, why the Russians are, yes, so bogged down there?
I can understand them being bogged down because the Pathans, believe you me, they can fight. When I say fight, they can be just as dirty as the Russians, if not more so. And the amazing thing is that I went through the Khyber Pass, and the people there, they were very friendly to your face, but they were very cunning at night. Now, they'd send, in your barracks, you always had down the centre of the barracks your rifle racks, and they were had long bars through the handles, through the grips, and bolted at that end, and the same at the top, that you pushed your rifle up like that, and then there was a iron rod going right through, and they'd even steal those. But the funniest way, if you couldn't look at it in a humorous way, you got to admire them. They'd get little boys, little thin boys, chicos as we call them, and they'd work them through the bars into the barracks where they were sleeping, and they'd gradually ease the blankets off the sleepers where they were sleeping, especially if there was a few drunks in there. It was easy enough, and pass them out to the folks outside, and then they'd scramble back through again. Many a night the soldiers have woken up with no blankets on. Oh yes, they were. And I was watching a football match there one day, and the sergeant's quarters would be a room like this at the end of the bungalow, and the corporal's a similar one at the other end of the bungalow. Well, this particular afternoon, well, it was evening, anyway, a very early evening, there was a football match going on, and this particular sergeant came out of his room and went over and watched the football. When he got back, his big trunk had gone. Nobody saw it go. So that I pity the Russians that's in Afghanistan, because they've got a nasty habit there. If they capture you, they won't touch you. They hand you over to the women. And they'll skin you alive.
Have you seen sort of evidence of what the women have done?
Only once. And it frightened me. I saw a chap in hospital. Fortunately, he'd been rescued in time. But the whole of his face was one mass of bandages. All you could see was two little slits for his eyes, and for his nose, for him to help breathe through. He'd been captured and handed over to the women. They'd started to skin him from the, all down there like that. Whether or not he eventually recovered, I wouldn't know. But it shook me rigid, absolutely. I thought, it's a good God, if that's what they do. Not safe to repeat, that unless I'm positive myself, I don't like saying, so-and-so told me this or he saw that.
Yes, and we appreciate this very much because it's the first-hand evidence we are interested in.
Yes.
But you actually saw this man.
Yeah.
And had heard
what had happened. Well, I saw him by virtue of the fact that I happened to go into the hospital. And he was, he was more or less like in an isolation room.
Did that make you all very frightened, knowing what would happen to you if you were taken by these people?
No, actually, you were warned never to use your last bullet on the enemy, preferably on yourself, because they knew the tortures they would put you through. That one of those things that, fortunately, I was never in a position to even think about it.
You were saying that you'd been up to the Khyber Pass, and through the Khyber Pass, I
yes,
think you said.
What
is it like, the Khyber Pass?
Oh, magnificent, really. If we look at it from a scenic point of view. I went up as far as a place called, was as far as we were allowed to go, called the Jamrud Fort. J-A-M-R-U-D. And a very amusing thing happened there was a caravan came through. Oh, an endless string of camels all loaded up with all sorts of stuff. And a couple of our chaps was playing with a native the three-card trick. And while we were there watching, an officer came up and he said, "Oh, now, what's going on here?" And this particular fellow said, "Oh, the three-card trick, find the lady." "Oh, it's how much have you lost?" We said, "Only about between 6 and 10 rupees. "Right," he said, "make him give it back." He said, "I'd rather you didn't, sir." "Oh," we said, "why not?" "Well," he said, "he's beaten me in my own game." He said, "I'm a demonstrator of the three-card trick at masculine advance." even the officer had to laugh. But anyway, he made them pack up there and then. It was most amusing there.
You were saying how lovely the Khyber Pass was.
Oh, yeah.
Was there magnificent vegetation and trees
no.
there, or was it barren?
No, barren, but I suppose frightening in a sense for the immensity of the rocks and that. It was terrific. But one of those awe-inspiring things, like you'd probably get in the Alps.
What were your living conditions like while you were in Waziristan? You've mentioned the amount of illness, things like the bugs.
Yeah, well, we had our own field bakery and what have you, and supplies was being brought up. Oh, there was no shortage of food as regards food.
And water, you said there were problems with water.
Oh, yes, problem with there were certain wells and that was always tested for purity before we were allowed to use it. And then they could bring water, too, up on mules with what they call the yakdans. So that the only thing that you... there was one particular incident there, which was rather terrifying at the time. We were on the march, and we'd started about 5 o'clock in the morning, and it would be about 11 o'clock, and we stopped to get into a shelter in our 10 minutes break. And one of the chaps took off his equipment and just dropped it down, and he sat down and leant back, and he gave a terrific scream. The boulder that he leant against was so hot that it took the skin off his shoulder, down his side. Oh, no wonder he screamed. So, of course, the doctor did what he could for him then, and got him on to a Camel ambulance and sent him back to headquarters for hospital.
Was it hot the whole time you were there?
Oh, terrific. Terrific, up in the... Yes.
How long would you have been there in all, do you think?
What in Waziristan? Well, it's a rough guess, I would say, possibly 6 or 7 weeks.
And the campaign
because we
was
were on the move.
Yeah,
we were on the move all the time, pushing them back further into the hills.
As you were on the move and when you made camp, would these have been tented camps you had? Your headquarters, for instance, would it have been a tent?
Oh yes.
At any one?
Yes.
Moment? Yes.
Except as I say, at Jandola Fort, when we had, we were in the fort.
How did you get on with the Indian troops? How did the British...
Oh, easy, easy, smashing blokes. But the finest were the Gurkhas. Oh, they were...
What was so outstanding about the Gurkhas?
In the first place, they didn't know what fear was. You couldn't fight them under any circumstances. And they were so companionable. They were the only troops at that period, or the only soldiers of that time that we were in India, that was allowed to use a white man's canteen. And they were only a penny a day less in payment than what we were getting. And believe you me, they were worth it. Then, of course, the Sikhs, they were a wonderful bunch too. But... amazing how strict they are with their lives as regard their religion. Extremely so. If one was having his lunch, we'll say, by the wayside, and I was walking along that particular road, the first thing he'd do is to turn his back round so that your shadow wouldn't fall on his food. That some of the things are more or less unbelievable, because some of the women working in the fields would give birth to a baby and then carry on working. To us, it seemed so unnatural. It was as if they weren't human beings, they were more like animals. And yet they were gentle and shy. Mostly the women were. But of course there were certain places set aside for soldiers' pleasures, if you so desired. But there was always the risk that it was...
Was there much trouble with venereal disease?
No, not in India. In India, No, fortunately, because I think the particular houses that were set aside for that sort of thing were strictly controlled by doctors. And everyone, if it was known that you'd been there, you had to report to the doctor that there was no chance of you getting away with even the slightest sign of a disease.
And would people do that, do you think? You know, even sort of sensitive people, would they go to the doctor afterwards?
I think so, because our regimental colonel, Colonel Johnson, by golly, he was strict, and yet he was father-like in his outlook towards his troops. And one day I know for a fact that he called a chap into the office. He said, I've had a letter from your mother. She says she hasn't heard from you for a month. No, sir. And he suddenly jumped up. He said, why? He said, you only got one mother. He said, sit down and write a letter right away. And if I get a second letter from her to say that you haven't written, he said, you're for it. And then he lectured the whole regiment then. He says, if I get any more letters or complaints about any of you chaps from either your mothers or your wives, he said, you'll have to answer to me.
Did you have letters from home? You know, and did your mother receive letters from you while you were in
Waziristan? Yeah, talking about letters from home. It was while I was in the malaria hospital in Dagshire that, as I say, I was due for the medical board. My mother received a telegram from the War Office warning her to expect bad news within the next few days. Now, my dad was ill in bed at that time, and my brother, older than me, was up in the bedroom at the time my mother got the telegram. She'd come up in the bedroom and read out this telegram. And my brother, oh, the essence of diplomacy, said, oh, perhaps he's dead already. My mother told me after, she said, I could have killed him. But the funny part of it was, the very hour that she got that telegram, which was about between 7 and 8 in the evening, I was out playing hockey. Out in the hospital grounds playing hockey.
Could I ask you, before we go on to Vladivostok, about the situation with communications and signals while you're in Waziristan?
Oh,
how would you have sent messages to the different detachments out in the field?
By heliograph. Not only by heliograph, but also by flag, semaphore. But heliograph was the most popular.
You wouldn't have had field telephones at all in that situation?
No.
I imagine it would be so far-flung, would it, the different campaigns?
Oh, yes,
for that.
Yes.
That did the communication system work pretty well in that area?
Oh, very
given
well.
Given the difficulty of the terrain?
Oh, yes. You could always find a vantage point that whereby you could signal. And now, say for instance, I suddenly recall a point now, where an officer come up to the general and I was just standing by his side. "For God's sake, General," he said, "get the artillery," he said, "to blast that point there." He said, "my men are going down like flies." So he said to me, he said, "just draw a rough plan, will you, and mark the spot at the top with an arrow where we want him to fire, and send the dispatcher off with it to the field artillery." And that's how we used to manage. It wasn't a question of getting hold of a field telephone and that. It was all done by signals or by written messages.
And the other thing, you mentioned about the court-martials, the job you had, and that there were one or two. What would the people have been court-martialed for, and what would have happened to them as a punishment if they were court-martialed?
Well, court-martials, chiefly in India.
Not in Waziristan?
No.
I see.
The punishment was delivered on the field.
And what that would have been? Death?
As I say, for fouling the water.
Oh, that would have been a court-martial crime, would it?
Yes. Uh-huh. And, well, they were dealt summarily there and then. But the court-martials that we dealt with in India was mostly as it was put on the charge sheet, of sodomy. That was the main thing.
That was homosexuality?
Yes.
Yes. And would that have been within Indian
groups? Oh, yes.
Yes.
Mostly in the Indian regiments. Mm-hmm. But none of the British was involved in that, thank God.
But it was quite prevalent, was it, within the...
I won't say altogether too prevalent, but nearly every case that I dealt with was with the Indian, in the Indian regiments.
Well, I think we must now go on to Vladivostok. How did you feel about leaving India? Did you know anything about Russia at that time?
No.
Or even the events that had been happening?
No.
Because I think you left India in, am I right in thinking,
1918? Yes, I beg your pardon, 1918, November 1918.
So it was late in 1918 that you left?
Yes, because we got into Vladivostok then the end of November 1918.
Right.